Welcome. You're listening to EA Spotlight on EA Business Radio. I'm your guest host, Bernie Wolford, filling in for Cliff Oxford. And our show is being broadcast live from the studios of Business Radio X here at Entrepreneur Advisors. Thank you to Trevor, our producer, and to all the staff of Entrepreneur Advisors. EA Spotlight is a weekly radio show featuring Entrepreneur Advisors members and their guests. Generally, we are led by Cliff Oxford, who is CEO of EA, an internationally renowned entrepreneur, and also Natalie Allen, EA's media strategist, and the members, of course, come in to discuss what they have learned from the, quote, school of hard knocks, unquote. So we invite you not only today, but to tune in on a regular basis to EA Spotlight to hear some valuable tips about those who have been in the trenches and learn how to move your revenue needle. Today, I am very pleased to be joined by my co-host, Lisa Romind. Lisa is Executive Director of Entrepreneur Advisors. Lisa, thanks so much for being here today and co-hosting.
Well, thanks for having me, Bernie.
Let's get started. I suspect with almost every show we do, there are a set of listeners who are hearing about EA and Entrepreneur Advisors for the very first time. So I think periodically it's good for us to give them a little couple-minute snapshot. What is EA? What is Entrepreneur Advisors? Who are your members? What's sort of your mission? And most importantly, what's coming up in the future that listeners might avail themselves of?
Well, we are the leader in entrepreneur education. We have a membership base of entrepreneurs who are moving to the next stage of their business. So we're really not for startups. We're for the second stage entrepreneur, what we call Entrepreneur 2.0. And generally, these are companies with revenues of $5 million to $200 million. And all of our members want to know and grow, as we like to say. We have another aspect of our organization. We sell our curriculum to colleges and universities, and we've been very successful in that. We will be initiating a six-day Entrepreneur 2.0 program at Kennesaw State this fall.
Excellent.
And Clayton State is also offering a two-day Entrepreneur 2.0 program, and we're talking to a lot of other colleges as well. So we're, like we said, we're the leader in entrepreneur education, and we are very excited about helping our members get to the next level.
And you do some events that you call symposiums. I've been around two of them, and I think you have another one now on the calendar for September.
Yes, we do. September 16th at the Cobb Energy Center. We will. It starts at 8 a.m. and will be ending at 11 a.m. And our shows just keep getting better and better. And I'd like to thank Jonathan Greenhill of Broadcast Atlanta. He has taken on the task of staging the past two shows. They've been global simulcast, and he has taken us to the next level. He has done an excellent job. We've got some exciting speakers, which will be announced later, but hope to see everybody out at the Cobb Energy Center on September 16th.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to have an exciting time in our studio today, Lisa. We have three outstanding guests, and the format we're going to use today is I'd like to introduce each one of them, and then hear their story, learn a little bit about who they are and their business, and then if we are lucky, better to be lucky than good, we'll save about 10 minutes on the very end of the show to do a bit of a roundtable discussion amongst our guests, which I personally enjoy. I get to sit back and listen. So our first guest is Mr. Wayne Curzon of the Curzon Group, and he is a certified Gazelles business coach who assists growth companies in the 5 to 100 million range get bigger, better, and faster results by providing new ideas, proven strategies, and customized solutions. He advises business owners how to use the right disciplines, tools, and thought processes to wrap around their industry expertise so they can execute and profitably scale the business. Wayne, welcome to EA Spotlight.
Thank you, Bernie. After listening to Lisa, I guess I'm a business coach 2.0, same target market. Yeah, we work essentially with business owners and executives who really want bigger and better results. That sounds kind of generic. But what we find with our clients essentially is the last thing they need is more industry knowledge. But what they're looking for is how to make that all happen. So we provide the habits, the ideas, the thought processes, et cetera. And our process, and you mentioned Gazelles Coach, I'm a certified Gazelles coach, and About 10 years ago, a guy named Vern Harnish documented the habits that made John D. Rockefeller so successful. And the book was called Mastering the Rockefeller Habits. Mm-hmm. And we find that you can take a look at a business, and there are actually just four decision areas that if you get these all right, everything seems to work. And those decision areas are the people, the strategy, the execution, and cash.
Mm-hmm. I have my own pecking order amongst those four that I see strengths and predictable weaknesses in the marketplace. What do you see, just sort of as an expectation, as you engage your next half dozen clients, what have you sort of come to expect with regard to the existing strong points you're going to inherit and then a lot of those weaknesses you're going to have to supplement?
Thank you. That's a good question. Essentially, our clients are business owners that really want to move ahead. And oftentimes they found themselves kind of on a plateau, and I call it the ceiling of complexity. Just can't seem to move the needle, whether it's revenue or profit or team performance, the way they want to. And so in a way they're kind of stuck. And we find that working through the four decisions, coming up with a strategic plan, and then an execution plan, and then the accountability, culture, and environment that allows you to execute, and then the measurements, we can break through that ceiling of complexity.
I guess one thing I observe, Wayne, and maybe you can help me out with your perspective and hopefully a solution, is I see a lot of environments where the business owner or the top leadership, the two or three key people, They read things, they attend events, they go to seminars, and they sort of depart all gung-ho, but then that's the extent of it. They don't have the ability to take what they've learned, personalize it, and implement it within their own organizations. Is that something that you can provide some guidance with?
Absolutely. I think we've all read a book, went to a conference, went to an EA event, symposium, or whatever. And we heard something, we said, we need to do that. And then we find in 2 to 3 months later, nothing's really happened. And it's kind of like I said at the beginning, it's not a lack of ideas so much, but it's the process and the environment that allows you to execute. And so we find that it's important to, in fact, one of our primary focus is on a 90-day plan where you come up with 3 to 5 very important priorities, and you limit yourself to those priorities. And then what are the action steps required to move forward? Who are we going to assign them to? And then what kind of a system of accountability are we going to have to make sure they get done?
Well, what do you see as the number one mistake business owners make?
I think the number one mistake that business owners make is they hang on to their B and C players too long. When you're in this small, mid-sized business area, we oftentimes know a lot about the people that work for us. We know their spouse, their situation, health things, all those kind of things. And it's really kind of heart-wrenching to let someone go. But at some point, we got to decide if we're primarily a business or a rehab center. And so I see that, and Jim Collins, you know, 10 years ago in Good to Great said that people was the most important decision area. And then last year he reaffirmed that in an interview with Inc. magazine, that people is still the most important decision area. And we can have a great product and a great delivery system, but if we get lousy people, we're not going to get the results we want. Conversely, it may not be the greatest product, it may not be the greatest system, but if you got great people, they're just going to make it happen. So my answer is it's getting an A team on board. If you're going to go to the playoffs, you can't get there with B and C players.
Well, how do you coach people though to let these people go if someone's got a great assistant that's been there 10 years, but she's just not doing the job, but they've become somewhat attached to her? Mm-hmm. How do you coach them, and what do you tell them that gives them the push to actually let these people go?
Well, the number one question I would ask is, would you enthusiastically rehire this person today? And that usually causes some real self-reflection there as to what's going on.
Would I marry her again?
But, you know, again, referring back to Jim Collins, but it's about having the right people in the right seats. The right people are the people who live by your culture or core values. And if you lined up your core values on the top of a spreadsheet and your people down the left side, and you went through and graded each one, you'll find if there's some people that are not really meeting your core values, they're just not the right people. Now, we would coach them through maybe a 30-day, hit them over the head with a 2x4, and you get 30 days to change this behavior. And if you don't change this behavior, you know, we're just not going to work for you, or it's not going to work for you to be here. And then the other thing is getting them in the right seats. And there's kind of like three criteria there. Number one, do they get it? Number two, do they want it? And I forgot number three. Are they competent? Can mm-hmm. they do it?
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Well, you're a certified Gazelles business coach. Tell me what that means and what you had to go through to be certified.
Well, Vern Harnish established the Gazelles organization, which is international. We got about 20,000 businesses now using the Rockefeller Habits. And so you go through a selection process based on your experience as a coach or in business, et cetera. And then go through some rather extensive training, and we get certified to actually present the four decisions, which we'll be doing this fall here in Atlanta. So it's a fairly select group. Right now, I think there's 40 coaches worldwide that are certified Gazelles coaches.
Wow.
Well, you, I guess as you made your decision on, you know, which organization to affiliate with and which consulting model seemed to fit your style and so forth, my personal experience is that it's a pretty crowded field, but you selected Vern Harnish and the Rockefeller Habits and the Gazelles. Can you share with us a little bit some of your own personal decision process to go in this direction versus other choices you may have had?
Well, I think, like most people in the decision process, you look for results. And in doing some research, I saw a lot of companies really that were fast growth. In fact, we call a Gazelles a company that grows at 20% or greater per year for four consecutive years. Mm-hmm. Then I started using the concepts with my own clients and saw some just fantastic results. And so it was an easy decision for me.
Okay, very good. Now, you have an event coming up on October 11th. Would you share with our listeners what's that about and who should consider attending and perhaps why?
Sure. The event is for really business owners and their staff, and it's called Rockefeller Habits Four Decisions. It's a one-day workshop where we talk about the ideas and concepts, give examples of companies that have used the concept and had some great results, and then we do some exercises. And then our kind of our marquee product here is what we call the one-page strategic plan, and we start the creation of that one-page plan, which is kind of A to Z from core values, brand promise, to five-year, three-year, one-year quarterly goals. So it's a one-day workshop, and it's going to really focus in on what you need to do to move your business forward, and it's a great opportunity and a great time to actually start looking at 2012.
Okay. For those listeners that are interested in attending, how do they register?
Okay. You can go to my website, and that'll lead you to an information flyer as well as a registration page. My website is WayneKurzen.com, that's WayneKurzen.com, and that will give you the information you need.
Great.
Well, thank you, Wayne, and we never have enough time to dig as deep as we'd like and always have many, many more questions, and hopefully you'll be able to come back on a future show and spend some more time and dig a little deeper in some of these issues.
Well, I'd love to, and one word, I found Octopreneur Advisors to be just a tremendous resource for education and really interacting with other folks, and really a good resource for business owners that want to move ahead.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. And hopefully you can continue to hang with us for a few more minutes while we go to our next two guests.
Be most happy to do so.
Okay, very good. Lisa, next up is Mr. Walter Lawrence. Walter is a CPA in Roswell. He has an MBA from Emory and a MAPW. That is a Master of Arts in Professional Writing. During his 37 years as a financial professional, he served as a financial analyst, auditor, controller, and CFO, working with some of Atlanta's largest and smallest companies. He spent a year commuting between Atlanta and Los Angeles. Now, there's a commute that even the Atlantans would complain about. Running the financial reporting systems for two subsidiaries of large Japanese construction companies. He owns his own company as a part owner and two others. He's a frequent instructor for CPE classes at the Society of CPAs in Georgia and nine other states. Walter's gift for teaching extends into his entire client base. Now, if that doesn't keep you busy, he is the author of the short story anthology, Take Me to Texas, published 2011, and hopefully the soon-to-be-published novel, Texas Cool Million. Oh, boy, I'm excited about that one. And his nonfiction work, Docs, D-O-C apostrophe S, Rules, is due out in early 2012. And Walter is a native Texan, hence, I guess, the mention of Texas in two of his books. Walter, welcome to EA Radio. Thank you so much for taking time to be here with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Bernie.
Tell us a little bit about the day job. I want to get to the books. The books are always exciting. But tell us about accounting integration and design and how that works. And then connect the dots with the writing of the books as well.
Well, it really started out when I was still living in Texas with my family. My father was a very successful veterinarian, and back in the 50s, that was a very cash-intensive business. And with that excess cash, he invested in and started up several business ventures. So I think at one time he had about six or seven going, and so I would go with him from one business to another, and I saw how mom-and-pop, essentially, operations took place. Later on, when I was working in the Big Eight accounting firm here in Atlanta, I was in their small business practice, which by definition was closely held, family held, and also the construction-related industries. One of the things that we saw happen time after time with the emerging companies that came out was that when they reached a certain critical level, and back in the mid-'80s, that was at about the $5 million range, they either had their act together and had the infrastructure to support the growth that the gazelles would need to do, or they became victims of their own success. There was just too much to do, and it spun out of control. And we had to clean up several of those situations. So what my enjoyment is finding the companies that are sort of in that sweet spot, just right at about the 2.0 level, and help them think through their reporting system. Turns out that studies have shown that there's only about 5% of the American population that can what they call tolerate accounting, that is doing accounting day after day after day after day. You have to have a certain mindset to do that. In construction companies, it's easiest to see, particularly for the smaller ones, the accounting jobs are usually done by the lowest talented person, usually a family member, the wife, the daughter, the daughter-in-law.
Exactly.
And it's just thrown off to them, whereas job costing is a very critical element of what they do. So you take that mindset, which it, in varying degrees permeates American business, and go to a much bigger company, and you still find that the information reporting and accounting work is usually the stepchild of the organization. Actually, when I was writing an article for a magazine locally here, the fellow's company did custom closets at high-end homes. And he looked across the table at me and said, "You know what's the difference between what you do professionally and what I do professionally?" He said, "It's the difference between being a hunter and a farmer." And I thought that was a very apt analogy, because true entrepreneurs, the spear chuckers, go out there and hunt the game. The camp followers, the people who maintain all the stuff, what we would call the backroom people, which includes the accountants, have a different mindset. They're both required, but too often the concentration, when somebody is said to be a visionary, they're talking about the hunting side and not the farming side. And what we do is help them bring them back over across the river and say, please give some, you know, some thought to what this is doing. And, oh, by the way, we will look at what your inefficiencies are, because as they evolve, most of them are inefficient, particularly in the smaller entrepreneurial things. Mm-hmm. And they're very painful to do. That's why people don't like to do them. So we basically take the pain out of it. And with the technology that's available today, that's quite easy to do.
So how do you start? I mean, you kind of predictably know what you're going to encounter as you go into the environment you have just described, where, you know, the financial discipline has yet to be installed, and the first professional, quote unquote, accountant or controller has yet to be hired. Is there a bit of a recipe, a menu for how you get started in moving that organization from sort of the lack of discipline into some pretty sound financial practices?
Yeah, in the profession, it's called fire eating, because you usually have to go out
and put
out the fires. First, you address the immediate needs. Obviously, you address the highest risk, which are the tax agencies, because they usually run afoul of that because their accounting systems, payroll systems, they'll skip tax payments, that kind of thing. So you cure that, and you basically step through and say, exactly how are you doing this? What is your system from beginning to end? Because any good accounting and reporting system is a closed loop, as I would see it. When they talk it through and put it down on paper, it is not a closed loop. It just kind of depends on people doing things that they forget to do.
Well, now, Walter, so many small businesses have failed due to lack of accounting controls. What issues or what items should be tracked within a company without fail? What do you advise?
Well, the number one and the most critical thing is cash, mm-hmm. because all arguments are settled in the bank statement. You know, you can do what you want. If you're not billing people, which it is surprising how many people skip that step. Oh, I intended to bill it. Didn't we bill it? You know, somebody else was going to bill it. All right, where's your system about making sure that that gets done? Billing is one thing. Collecting is another. So then we go through, you know, what is the full cash cycle and who is responsible? In other words, as they would say in the construction industry, whose belly button am I going to push when this money doesn't come in? So we assign those things. We assign the tasks and have the responsibilities so that the owner remotely, while they're out doing what they do, can, with a phone call or with an iPad, keep track of here's where I am. The most useful, particularly to the smaller companies, is to have basically a daily, which is very easy to do now with the reporting systems of banks, a daily cash position, which mm-hmm. says here's what I've got in the bank, here's what I've got in payables, here's what I've got in collectibles, here's what I expect of those collectibles to come in for a period of time. And then some follow-up mechanisms say, here's what I estimated was going to happen. Here's what did happen. Why the difference? And that's the key. Why the difference? And what are we doing about it? And how long does it take us to find out that our expectations aren't being met? Because obviously the less capital you have, the more critical the turnover is. So you have to manage that more closely.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the cell phones and the iPads. With all the new technology, does financial reporting still have to be labor intensive? Is there an easier way to do it, or
there's a cheaper way to do it?
Uh-huh.
One of the companies that one of my related companies deals with brings in international people and helps them get relocated. And I was having a dinner with one of the German nationals who works down here, just down Peachtree Street. And it turns out that their processing plant is just outside of Hanover, Germany. Their headquarters is here in Atlanta, but all their accounting is done in Bulgaria.
Wow.
It's kind of like, they have got the idea from looking at the American business models, because with, you know, whether you're offshoring it to Bulgaria or India, or there are a number of organizations that have economies of scales, because they do nothing but the accounting process, bookkeeping, if you will, that can be done through remote entry cheaper than you can get your kin to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So what usually happens is first they do it themselves, then they push it off to somebody in their circle of influence, or family members, and finally they'll outsource it because they find that it's more reliable, it's a quicker turnaround, and it's actually the least expensive alternative that they've got.
What's the real cost of outsourcing?
In terms of dollars?
Yeah, or dollar, yes, dollars, or even just employee base.
Well, actually, let's talk about the benefit side of it. One of the things when you have an outside service like that, because you have a contractual arrangement, one of the things that you have to do is the owner, the business that's having this outsourced, has to hit certain deadlines. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's Tuesday, you have to turn in this. If it's the first month, you have to turn in that. If it's internal, particularly somebody who doesn't have that skill level, those deadlines will slide, and that's what gives rise to the problems. I mean, it's even got to the point now with technology where you don't even have to have an accounts payable person. That can all be done if you've got a fax machine or a scanner. You can send it out. It'll get paid, and you can just upload it into your software for pennies on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess in my lifetime, and as I look around the room in the lifetime of a few of us, we've seen these functions we're talking about go from the back room and the eye shades and the garters around the sleeves and all these things. And now the next stage with the advent of electronic processing, all that paper was moved onto a software platform, but usually something that resided there physically in the office area. Now, so many things are moving onto the cloud. Is that having a significant impact in the financial industry, Walter?
Yes, it is, particularly for the small companies. There's a term that's called accounting nephology. Nephology is a term in meteorology that is the study of the formation and the activity solely of clouds. So you can say,
okay,
rather than
tell
people, all you need is an internet link, or internet connection through your cell phone, you can transmit that. You can transmit that anywhere you are in the U.S. In other words, an entrepreneur can travel, still do his transactions, and not be dependent on being at the home office as he once was, just only several years ago.
So as long as I can get on the internet, which is increasingly more available than it's ever been, I can stay up with my financial status. I can look at my P&L, my cash flow, my receivables.
All you have to do is find a Starbucks.
There you go.
You have an accounting department.
Very good. Well, Walter, once again, thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us. And as we requested Wayne, hopefully you'll be amenable to coming back and taking some deep dives.
Sure.
And before we let you go, let's spend just a few minutes on the books. I don't necessarily, in Bernie Wolford's brain, connect the discipline of credits and debits and financial planning with the creativity of writing books. You obviously are one of these people that can do that. Tell us a little bit about the books you've done and those that are about to be published.
The one that I would like to talk about is the one that's just coming out. It's called Take Me to Texas. It's the anthology, which is the subtitle is called Lone Star Stories of Love and Other Adventures. It's 12 short stories. Some are reminiscent of nostalgic. Some are coming of age of some in business and that kind of thing. But they all touch Texas in some way because that's the discipline. You mentioned that you've seen through my marketing ploy of Texas being in the title of both of them, and that's because Texas sells. Texas has done a great job of branding itself. They brag that there are no five more powerful letters in the English language than T-E-X-A-S.
I can hear the Texans I know shaking their heads and saying, yeah, we agree with that.
Now, you have a fan page for these books, don't you?
Yes, I do. They're both title specific, so they're both on Facebook. So it's facebook.com/take.me.to.texas. The novel yet to be published is same thing. It's facebook.com/texas.cool.million. And it's when it comes out, I'll tell you that story.
Excellent. Well, Walter, for those that are listening who would like to contact you regarding accounting, integration, and design, what's their best means of doing so?
We have a website. It's accountingintegrationdesign.com. And it's also available. We have a fan page as well. So if you Google either one of those, you'll get to us.
Great.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. And once again, hopefully you can stay for another few minutes while
sure.
we go to our third guest. Okay, Lisa, our next guest is Roy McCreary. And I got to tell you, got to be self-disclosing, a light bulb went off when I heard about Roy being on the show today. Roy is an actor, and it occurred to me that all of the things that I've learned about entrepreneurism and success and being an entrepreneur apply to an actor and perhaps his or her agent who have to create business, keep clients mm-hmm. happy,
market
themselves, create a brand of themselves. It just occurred to me for the first time in my life that there may be no better model of a true, pure entrepreneur than an actor or actress who has to make all these things happen.
Uh-huh. I think you're right.
So let me introduce Roy. You may not recognize the name, but there's a good chance you've seen Roy somewhere before. He's been a spokesperson for many of the top Fortune 500 corporations. He's appeared in scores of national commercials. He's also had roles in 7 feature films and a dozen television shows to date. Next week, he will be appearing as Dr. Jim Felton in the new hit series Necessary Roughness. The strange thing is that he's been doing all of this while living outside of Hollywood in New York. Who would have thought you could do that? And we have another writer with us today, Lisa. He's just written a book about his experiences called Acting for a Living, which will be on sale on Amazon and Kindle later this month. Roy, thank you so much for being a guest on EA Spotlight.
It's a pleasure. And I must say, Bernie, I think you hit the nail right on the head there with your short assessment there. Before you introduced me, you're exactly right. I mean, I think that's kind of what the book sort of touches on, that acting is a business, first mm-hmm. and foremost. And I think that's why I go into that in pretty big detail in my book, because I think that's what most actors honestly don't get about acting. They think of it more as an art form. But essentially, it does translate very well into entrepreneurial skills and into business.
So this would sound like the book, Acting for a Living, sounds like something that a person who seriously wants to make a living in this industry, even if they have all the skills of being an actor or actress, there is that business side. Is that the target market you're going for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think most people – well – I would say that I think acting might be the most misunderstood job in the world, to be perfectly honest. It also might be the most competitive job in the world, if you think about it. I mean, there are potentially millions and millions of people throughout the world that want to be an actor or are trying to be actors, but there's only a tiny fraction that actually are able to make a living at it. And I think a lot of the misunderstanding comes where most people think you need to be famous or you need to be a star in order to be successful. And we've all heard the term starving actor.
Sure.
And I think most of the world feels that you fall into one category or the other. You're a star or you're starving. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that's not the case. In any major city in the United States and for the most part in the world, you have people making a living as actors. And we've all seen those corny little commercials, local TV commercials, and they look funny and they look cheap. And we've all seen those horrible industrial videos of training films and things like this. But you'd be shocked how much money you can make doing those things. And it is quite conceivable to make a very good living as an actor.
Well, tell us about your beginnings. When did you look in the mirror and say, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, it was funny, late in life, because I started out in college as an economic and political science major, and I had no desire to be on the stage. In fact, I hated speaking in front of people. The worst thing that could happen to me was to have to give a speech in front of my class. Yeah. I was terrified. So I never would have envisioned that I'd be doing this now, but as fate would have it, I started out as a salesman and worked for many different corporations selling pretty much everything under the sun that you can imagine. And my foray into acting began with a disaster. My company that I happened to be working for went out of business. And I thought, you know what? I'm sick and tired of starting at the ground floor. I'm going to do what I want to do. And it just so happened that the first thing that popped into my head was acting. And I started exploring it. And fortunately for me, I wasn't in Hollywood at the time or New York at the time. I was in Atlanta. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because had I been in Hollywood or New York, I probably would have been a full-time waiter. it just so happened that I happened to be outside of the mainstream where all the actors are. and by default ended up not following the herd. And so you could say it was dumb luck, but I just fell into it.
How'd you know what steps to take?
Well, I just started asking questions. You know, it's funny, when you start asking questions, it's pretty soon you start finding people that have the answers. Mm-hmm. And it's a very simple process, and it wasn't long before I came across a fellow who was making a living as an actor full-time. And he agreed to show me a few things, and then I started taking some classes. And I jumped in a few local plays, auditioned for a couple of plays and local productions, and honestly, everything just fell into place. The agents came to me. I was signed by some agencies, and I've been working full-time ever since. It was the easiest thing I've ever done, strangely enough.
That being said, why are so many actors unsuccessful?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I think they're unsuccessful, again, because this is such a misunderstood business. Frankly, they're going about it all wrong. And it's probably a little bit of a parable for business in general. Most actors don't know anything about acting. They don't know how to become an actor. And so they follow the herd mentality. And they head to New York or they head to L.A. And they end up doing what most actors do, which is not acting. Mm-hmm. So that's the first mistake. Secondly, I think most people approach this as an art rather than as a business. And I found, coincidentally, that most of the people who are successful in this business don't have drama backgrounds, strangely enough. They have business backgrounds. I come from a sales background. A good friend of mine who has a fantastic resume, Wilbur Fitzgerald, he's the president of the local SAG organization. Mm-hmm. He was an attorney. He didn't start acting until his mid-30s. So those are good backgrounds for someone who wants to be an actor because the skill sets are the same. It's all about communication, presenting yourself well, self-confidence, and having a good business acumen and just being organized. Those are the necessary requirements.
I'm not sure I could learn to do certain things like crying on cue. I mean, are you born with that? Do you stick a knife in your side? Do you think of the pet you lost as a child? I mean, you know, how do you do these things.
That's so funny. You know, I'm asked that question an awful lot. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people write acting off. You know, they think, oh, I could never cry if I had to cry or do something like that. But the truth is you don't have to. I've never had to cry on cue in 20 years. And if I had to, I couldn't do it. Many actors, Laurence Olivier couldn't cry on cue. You don't have to be able to do that. The problem, and this sort of touches again on the problem of why so many actors are unsuccessful, they focus so much on what they can't do. And they spend their time taking classes and trying to work on what they can't do rather than working on what they can do and stressing their strong points because those are your sales points, right? Mm-hmm. Focus on your skill sets that are good, where you do stand out from the crowd. Maybe you can't cry on cue, but maybe you're really good at laughing. Mm-hmm. Or maybe mm-hmm. you're really good at being sincere. Those are your strong points then, and that's where you need to focus on.
Okay. There are a couple things I know I could never be. I could never be a salesman, and I suspect I could never be an actor because this word rejection would haunt me.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it's a broken paradigm, like you mentioned just a minute ago, but, you know, my current thought process is this thing called a casting call, and people lined up around the block, mm-hmm. and there are hundreds, only one's going to be chosen, and everyone else gets labeled rejected. I mean, do you learn to deal with that, or is that just me?
No, it's definitely the general opinion of the vast majority of people out there. In my opinion, this is, again, a reason why the mindset of so many actors is wrong. There is no rejection in acting. There is zero rejection in acting. I have been a door-to-door salesman. That's rejection.
There you go.
When you get a door slammed in your face and somebody tells you to get off their lawn, that's rejection.
Okay.
When you're acting and you go to an audition and they don't pick you, you just didn't close that opportunity. I mean, that's not rejection. Nobody calls you on the phone and says,
different.
You stink, you can't act, you know, what are you thinking?
Okay.
You just don't get the job. They're all opportunities. They're all chances for you to make potentially a lot of money and do very well. And if you don't close that opportunity, well, that's okay. There's another opportunity coming right around the corner. So it's all a plus. There are no minuses. So it's just how you look at it. I think if you approach this business with the right – really to be successful in this business, we've all heard of the 80-20 rule. And actually, I think we've touched on that a little bit earlier today. But in acting, it's so competitive. If you take all the actors in the world or in the nation, it's more the 99-1 rule. You have to be in that top tiny percentile in order to make a consistent living. What I've noticed is that the people who are in that top tiny percentile are not there because of talent. They're there because of their mindset and how they approach the business. And that's what separates them. There are potentially tens of thousands of Al Pacinos out there, or maybe mm-hmm. there are people that are better than Al Pacino, but they'll never be where he is because they're not approaching it from a business standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess a lot of actors and actresses do write books, probably, albeit with the help of a ghostwriter, their biography or autobiographical. Mm. You chose to write about the business mm-hmm. of acting. When did that thought pop into your head, and how did you decide to act on that?
Well, it's funny. I was actually on a shoot a few years back, and one of the producers came in. As people often do, I'm often asked, you know, how did you get into this? People don't understand the business at all. And he said, how did you get started? And finally he got down to how much money do you make? Are you a waiter part-time?
Yeah,
do you know? And it just occurred to me then that he just had no idea that the money you could make in this business. I'm paid like a surgeon. But I don't have to deal with blood, and I don't have malpractice insurance. And
unlike the surgeon, you get to keep yours. Right?
Absolutely. And I didn't have to go through 8 or 12 years of college to get there.
Yeah.
It's the best job you never heard about.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, I, in fact, the acting is great, but the time not acting is even better because I can make a good living working 1 to 2 days a week. So, it's on paper, and you get health insurance. You get, it's not like you're living on tuna fish every day.
Right.
So I guess what I'm saying is that this is a job that probably a lot of people out there, especially in sales, would be very, very good at. It's just that they've never considered it possible, and they've never encountered it as a realistic, legitimate career path.
I think many must be like me. My perception until today was that you're either working and doing very, very well, or you're not and not doing very, very well.
That's right.
It's black or white, hot or cold. And you've sort of opened my eyes that it can be something completely different than
Well, acting is a sales job. It really is sales. It's just that you're the product. You're not selling a car or a home. You're selling yourself. And if you're good at sales, then you're probably someone who's self-confident, who presents yourself well, who communicates well. And those are the qualities needed for acting. So, yes, believe it or not, you probably could be a very good actor. You're a very good communicator. And that's what it takes. That's what acting is.
What do you think, Lisa? Screen test next week?
I don't think it's for me. But I heard there was a story about that you lost some income on The Patriot that you had the opportunity to make.
To
make some money and
well, it's just funny. I mean, the ridiculous amount of money that's in movies is just insane. I was in The Patriot. It was the first major movie I was in, and I had three little words that I had to say: "Rebel dispatches, sir." That was my line. "Rebel dispatches, sir." I had to say it with an English accent. So I actually had friends that say, "Well, Roy was an extra in The Patriot," and I say, no, I wasn't an extra in The Patriot. That's a role. You actually had to audition for that role. I had to go to 3 callbacks for that role and beat out hundreds of actors to be able to say those 3 words. But it was worth it because that ended up paying for my car. And had I appeared in – it could have been much better than that. Had I appeared in I was supposed to be in the scene where where Mel Gibson runs and shoots all the people down, ambushes them. Had they brought me back for that scene, and our fight advisor said that they should have, but Mr. Emmerich was trying to save a buck or two. So
it is a business, right?
But yeah. Had they brought me back for that scene, I could have bought a house. So it's shocking the amount of money. I still get residuals from The Patriot. And
seriously,
yeah, and that was filmed in 1998.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Well, Roy, as with our other two guests, Lisa, I wish we had so much more time to take deeper dives. But as we wrap with you, Roy, someone who's listening who wants to get in contact with you, particularly if they want to find and read your book, how would they best go about doing that?
Well, the book's going to go on sale later this month on Amazon and Kindle. It's called Acting for a Living. And my website's under construction right now, but it'll hopefully be up later this week. That's actingforaliving.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you. Well, let me open it up now to our other guest who've been patiently waiting and listening. Walter or Wayne, do you have a question or two for Roy? And Roy, did you have a question or two you might want to ask Walter or Wayne about just this whole subject of entrepreneurship? And we have three quite different forms of it today. Walter, I know you've been taking some notes.
I'll start. If acting represents entrepreneurism, what is the main thrust of your book? What is the one piece of advice you would tell fellow actors that we can then turn around and tell businesses?
Think unlike the herd. That's probably the most important thing. The vast majority of actors are unsuccessful for a reason, and it's surprisingly often not because they lack talent and ability. They're unsuccessful because they're thinking like everybody else. And it just stands to reason that if you think like the herd or if you follow the herd, pretty soon one day you're going to lift up your head and realize you're in the middle of the herd. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get out in front, you're going to at some point have to break away and start thinking outside the box.
As I was listening to Lawrence, a thought came to mind, a saying we use is that profit is theory and cash is reality. and the term cash conversion cycle, shortening the time from meeting the prospect to getting paid on delivery of the product. What are some of the things that you recommend that entrepreneurs can do to shorten that cycle?
Well, one of the things that we find is that QuickBooks is used by a lot of entrepreneurs. Even when they go up, they can migrate up to enterprise solutions. The new buzzword for what you're talking about is called business intelligence. Mm-hmm. Back when I was at Emory in the B School, we used to call it ratio analysis. It's the same thing, you know, cash conversion, how many days do you have in receivables, that kind of thing. But there are add-ins that you can get to any software that can basically draw from your system and say, here's your ratios, and particularly, you know, how long is it going to take to collectible, how much do you have in receivables, that kind of thing. And then look at it over a period of time and say, okay, if I want it to go from here, which is okay, to here, which is better, which one of these parts do I have to move? And when you show that to people, and then they can watch it, and they can watch it on their iPhone from, you know, Starbucks and say, oh, here's how we're doing today. But business intelligence and the ratios is probably the best. Another way of looking at it is one of the things is common among the people that I deal with. They say that cash is a socially acceptable way of saying I love you. you can say what you want. Where's the cash?
I love that. Lisa, any final pressing questions you must ask before we let these great guests go?
No, but I would like to thank all three for their time today. This has been great.
Yeah, great show. And entrepreneurism in different forms. Roy, I so like what you're saying. I mean, it's as applicable to your job as it is to Walter and Wayne and their clients. And I like the standing out from the herd. You know, you can go get anyone to do anything for you and buy anything from the center of the herd. But we should all be looking. Who's out there? Who's the outlier? You know, what are they all about, and why are they an outlier? And I think that is the entrepreneurism mentality. Many people who I know personally, 20, 25, 30 years in traditional corporate America, who will never, ever, ever go back, even if there were a job for them to go back to. But they need to know these things and pick up these learnings that other people have, so that they know how to launch. They've taken orders and executed those orders well. Now some of them are almost clueless as to how they can do that on their own behalf. All right, guys. Thank you again. Lisa, thanks for being a great co-host. I'm going to ask
Cliff. Thank you, Bernie.
I'm going to ask Cliff for 2 hours next time. This isn't nearly enough. But thanks again to our many listeners for joining us on EA Spotlight. Thank you, Trevor, for making us sound so good. And to all the great folks at Entrepreneur Advisors and Business Radio X, EA Spotlight broadcasts a live show each Monday at 1 o'clock with podcasts available at all times on our website, which is easpotlight.businessradiox.com. And while there, please check out all the other great shows on Business Radio X. So this is your host, Bernie Wolford. Have a great week, everyone.